Now, film has always been 30 years behind time and technology, so the psychological aspect of it hasn't really changed, even though the technology has.
Are most of our movie theaters still sending, still using a strip of film 35 or 70 millimeters wide, or are a lot of the movie theaters moving over to a digital projection technique? Over to you, Eric.
No, there are quite a few multiplexes that haven't seen film since they've been built, unless, of course, you're talking IMAX, but IMAX also has a wavelet equivalent. The problem with IMAX is that the new projectors that Christie has been making, it really works out well. But those are 4K by 4K projectors. You know, they're micro-millions. And they're slightly problematic. Don't forget IMAX is 65 millimeter. And the film sits on a platter. It doesn't run up and down. It runs left and right.
Now, when I was at the IMAX theater about 4 years ago, I did see this platter with this great big roll of film, no reel, so to speak, on this platter, horizontally picked it off, where gravity is holding this reel of film with no reel on it against this platter. And I presume that was being run through the machine during this IMAX. And is IMAX still done that way, or is it starting to eventually go over to digital techniques? In the case of IMAX, I'm going to guess there's at least three projectors to give you all of that width of that screen. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Negative. The three projector thing was Cinerama. True Cinerama. I haven't done it in years. I think the last one was around the world in 80 days. I could be wrong about that. But no, because if you've ever looked at an IMAX film frame, and it goes through the projector not vertically but horizontally. And it's a very, very wide piece of film, and there's an anamorphic lens on the front of it to deal with the curvature of the screen.
Okay. The film's going through the camera horizontally. Each individual frame of the film, rough guess, how many millimeters wide, how many millimeters high on this horizontal transport going through that amorphic, that crazy lens. Over to you, Eric.
By the way, it's not too anamorphic like you see CinemaScope, which really requires an anamorphic lens. This lens, it takes this very rectangular image. It's 65 millimeters high. I mean, I could go look at my Fitzy book and give you the exact dimensions. But it's like three standard 70 millimeter high frames stacked one next to each other. Each frame is very, very wide. That's why it's at high resolution.
So everything that goes on that great big curved screen that I see, is all of that coming out of one lens? And is there one active frame during that instant that's projecting the signal into that lens? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, and Super IMAX, or what the hell they call it, that runs at 60 frames per second, and the average, the normal IMAX runs at 30 frames. Yeah, all coming out of one lens. And this is a lot of territory, and there's a huge light source for the film version and an even huger light source for the micro-mirror version.
Now, I think ordinary old-fashioned film used to be 24 frames per second. Each frame flashed on the screen twice so that the human being doesn't see flicker, although you certainly do see stroboscopic effects when you've got something like wagon wheels moving in front of you. If IMAX is 60 frames per second, and the human eye can only see flicker at about 30, boy, that seems like it's a lot more quality than was really required. But maybe I'm wrong here. Over to you, Eric.
No. The faster you project it, if you go beyond the persistence of the eyeball, you get an increase in apparent resolution. So what used to look like film, when you take a regular 24 frame per second film that's projected twice, the eyeball seeing 48, if you run that at 60, it looks like video almost.
Hmm. Is IMAX going to stay film, or is it possibly going to go over to digital?
You know, I went to a demonstration like about 3 or 4 years ago at the, what theater was it? It was the IMAX theater on 860, where they had one of the new Christie electronic projectors. You can see the micromirror, you know, you see the little square pixel, so to speak, if you look very carefully at the screen, especially if the projection is made nice and sharp. But it's, that's 4K by 4K. A lot of the normal electronic theaters are 2K by, you know, they call it 2K by 2K. So, there is a very marked increase in resolution, and all IMAX films are actually processed electronically, where they do a lot of edge enhancement and a few other noise reduction techniques that give it that really gorgeous quality.
That rather popular movie that I can't think of the name of now, a sci-fi movie in three dimensions a couple of years ago, was that done electronically as far as the projection that I saw and the theater I most likely went to? Eric, go ahead.
Well, it could have been filmed. It could have been, you know, 65mm IMAX film, or it could have been electronic. They still have both, but they process the images electronically and put it back on film, by the way.
Do you see movie theaters likely to move all to digital and essentially get rid of film?
Well, not only is that happening, and you can go to a lot of theaters today and it's all electronic projection, but the acquisition of program material of movies these days is being done electronically. They're not being done on film.
And I guess that gives you a lot more editing capability. To edit a piece of film by cutting and gluing and whatever has got to be a painful process compared to the equivalent of Photoshop, I presume, is a much higher version, excuse me, a higher fidelity version of Photoshop by which you can electronically edit. Is that true, Eric?
Well, for the past, I guess, 15 years now, nobody has ever used a Steinbeck table or a movie, almost 20 years now. If you look at the end of a film, you'll probably see that there'll be a credit given to Avid or to Final Cut, which are electronic editing systems now, or you won't see movies being done with Adobe Premiere. Premiere, by the way, is the Photoshop, the Adobe editing program, which some people like. I don't like it that much, but Avid pretty much has the game in California. And what they do is they take the dailies and they transfer the negatives directly to video or to high-definition video. And all the editing is done electronically. They haven't manually done editing in God knows how many years. But each film frame has something called an edge number and something called edge code, which is actually from magnetic stripe, which has the frame numbers on it. And that becomes an edit list. And those time codes get fed into the machine, and when they finish editing, they read out all those numbers, and when they print the CRI or the inner negative, that's going to be the printing roll of film that the release print is going to be made from. What it does is it will take and literally electronically splice together the negative cutter, will in essence have that list. You're going to still semi-manually do it. They will eliminate it drop. They will take those edge numbers and literally splice the negative up and splice the negatives together to make the CRI for the color reversal intermediate to make the release prints on a aerial image printer. Although today, they don't cut up the film. They basically, the aerial image printer will take that list of numbers. You put the first roll of negative up on there. It will then print onto the CRI the, you know, it starts at frame number 2000 and ends at frame number 3000. It will print that onto the film. The film advances. Put up the next net roll of negative. Print the frames that needed to be printed from that. Put up the next roll, etc., etc. So it's sort of random access on the printing machine.
I'm not quite sure why it's got to be random access. Of the movie theaters today, are at least half of them still using film that they project onto that screen?
Yeah, what the movie theaters get is they get a release print. Okay, I'm talking about the actual creation process of the release print. You do your editing electronically on an Avid, which is an editing system. Okay, you get your edit list out of it. That's the only thing that comes out of it. You don't take the images out of the machine. That list goes to the printer. The printer will then locate the frames that you use on negative roll number one. You may have 80 takes on one roll, and you need maybe 10 frames from this take and 50 frames from that take, and the printer will print those 10 frames, roll the film down to the next plate, print those frames, roll the film down to the next plate, print those films, and you're done with that roll of negative. Then you put up the next roll of negative, and it'll keep doing the same thing until you have a finished movie.
Quite a process. Back to you, Alan, KC2RFN, K2RIW.
K2RFN,
K2RIW.
One more question, if it's not too late, Dick.
You got Don, LDY, in there also.
John, what do you suggest as a tiebreaker?
Well, LDY has been trying to get in since last week.
LDY, go ahead.
Okay, I'll save last week's question for next week. It's not that important. I got two things to ask real quick. One, just clarify when you were talking, I was trying to get in before when you were talking about the satellite and the rain. Are you specifically talking about rain, or are we talking about like heavy cloud cover on that question?
Okay. Rain itself, when it gets heavy enough, the raindrops are no longer round, and so for these overlap frequency ranges that are used on certain kinds of satellites, the overlap frequencies are no longer separated and they get mixed together. So repose your question one more time, Don. N2LDY, K2RIW.
Okay, so as opposed to rain, if you have really heavy cloud cover, how much of an effect does that have on the signal getting through?
To my knowledge, cloud is not a problem. I think these signals go through clouds very nicely. I think it's only the good-sized raindrops on KU band, 11 gigs. When it comes to 24 gigs, I'll bet your clouds start giving troubles. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2EJ. On KA band, cumulus clouds begin to give you a little bit of a hard time. Thunderheads make your signal go away. Those clouds go up to 30,000 feet because they're really saturated with water. They haven't really fallen to the ground yet. Thunderheads are not really that much of a problem with KU band. You'll see some signal degradation, but it won't kill you. And on C band, it takes a real bad rainstorm to start to bother you there. KA band, thunderheads, just like you might as well just go home.
And when I was running my 8-foot diameter C-band dish for direct television reception, TVRO, television receive only terminal, I can remember two or three occasions when an extremely heavy rainstorm appeared to make the signal disappear. but it didn't disappear in amplitude. In my case, it disappeared in angle of arrival. If I repositioned the dish, I found it again during the rainstorm. Then when the rainstorm went away, the signal disappeared, and I had to reposition the dish to bring the signal back again. I wonder if you've ever experienced that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
You got to remember that I deal with 6, 7, and 8, 9 meter dishes, so it don't bother me that much. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. I've experienced that in my little 10 and 12 foot dishes.
So in the case of C-band, 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz, rain in that case is a dielectric material which steers the signal in some other direction. But when the signal goes through the material, it doesn't get distorted. It just gets steered a little bit. You get up to the much smaller wavelengths of KU band, 11 gigs. It's not create a polarization grief. And when you get up to 24 gigs, KA band, now clouds, particularly thunderheads, are going to give you significant attenuation. So each frequency region has got its own characteristics. Over to you, Don, K2RIW.
Oh, okay, thank you for that clarification. One last quickie here. I was building a cubicle quad, and I just wanted to know, what would be the best place to look, online or something, for like the matching of the driven element?
I'd start over the ARL antenna book. The ARL antenna book has got a nice chapter on each of the antenna types, like cubicle quads, loops, yagis, dipoles, fan dipoles, and so on. I'm pretty sure if you Google the right words, you'll find data. But by way of a good library, or if you're going to do any significant antenna work, one way or another, I think you're going to want to own that ARL antenna book. When I go to the antenna design department of a lot of high-class companies, almost every one of those guys, the chief engineer, will have a copy of the ARL antenna book on his bookshelf. Sometimes it's turned around backwards. You can't see what it is. He's not willing to admit he's using a ham radio manual, but there's a lot of good data there. Back to you, Don.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the answers, and I'm going to be clear right now. I'm listening. This is N2LDY. Thanks again.
Very fine, Don. We've only got a half hour left before the machine's going to be turned off, and I know Wesley's got some questions. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. We have a half an hour for it. Thanks to one of the gentlemen who made it happen. Anyhow. I have sent you the email that is, the email says, a final version for the TechNet 12/2012 sent by, at 5:53 p.m.
Okay, I'm getting that one right now.
Yeah. On the top of it, there is a YouTube a video for 4 minutes, but we don't have a 4 minutes right now left. This one shows a very interesting experiment with the radioactive material that is widely available and how that material impacts the spark. But then underneath of it you have a first diagram which is you see kind of three wave forms, and I would like to discuss that.
Okay, I found one that was issued on February 8th at 4:19 p.m. Do I have the right email to begin with?
No, that one was sent today at, hold on. That one was today, sent today at 5:53 p.m. Says final version for the TechNet 2012, and it says spark detector for alpha particles, HTTP, and whatsoever. That's the title.
think I just found it. Stand by. 5:53 p.m. Okay, I got that one. And sure enough, spark detector for alpine particles. Is that the one that I'm supposed to look at?
Yes. Well, if you want to go quickly to that, yes, we can go. It is just interesting. Anybody who wants to have access to that video, just go to YouTube and put spark detector for alpha particles, and you're going to have it. So this one, if you want to go to this one, shows a square plate with a aluminum cylinder inside and the two copper brackets. Between these two copper brackets, you have a thin wire, and then 8,000 volts is delivered to that, and the spark is not there, is not present. When the person put in the vicinity of that wire, he puts radioactive material from smoke detectors, for alpha radiation, then what he says, alpha particles and other ionizing particle radiation of the high linear energy transfer leave a dense, weak ionization following their passage through the air, which can trigger electrical breakdown in sparking in presence of suitably strong electric field. So this material is available. Everybody can have it, buy it. He was delivering between 6 to 8 kilovolts, and he was having a nice spark. The wire that was used was spaced in 0.2 inches. The wire to cathode, which is the cylinder spacing, is 0.1 inches. And the tungsten wire is standard unstrengthened 0.003 inch, 0.07 millimeter diameter. And what he says is a current limited power supply must be used that will not burn out the wires during the discharges. I suggest resistance of 20 megaohms in cathode lead made of resistors that are rated to handle the voltage of the supply. So what interesting is that the sources of alpha radiation demonstrated in the clip include 5 millicurie PO 210 source and 60 millicurie AM 241 source and 10 millicurie RA 226 source. Other effective but less dramatic sources include natural ambient red radon and the uranium ore. Pure beta emitters, gamma emitters, and X-rays do not trigger this kind of detector. That means that those emitters will not affect spark. He also says in this video where he got that radioactive material from, and you can buy it, anybody who wants to experiment it. It's sealed and it's safe. And to Exia.
Yeah, I'm about two-thirds of the way through that video right now. I see a round metallic object in the center being suspended by this brown surface. At the first experiment, he looked like he was holding on to something like a neodymium magnet.
It's the radioactive material. He gives the model number, and this radioactive material comes from the smoke detector. So all he has is two brackets. Between two brackets, you see the thin wire, and there is a spacing between metal cylinder that is made from aluminum. There is nothing magic about the aluminum. He just didn't want it to have it expensive for him. The spark appears to be there when he puts that very, very small amount of radioactive material nearby the vicinity of the wires, approximately 4 inches, 3 inches, 4 inches from that wire stop.
So am I seeing, because of the presence of the radioactive material, I'm seeing a whole bunch of blue sparks, and those blue sparks are occurring between the wire and the aluminum cylinder, is that true?
Correct. And he uses 6 to 8 kilovolts only.
And he's operating it in air, not in a vacuum.
It's correct.
And I presume the thin piece of wire is being suspended between those two copper strips, one on the left side, one on the right side?
Correct, like a zigzag, zigzag, zigzag.
Yeah, there are four conductors there, Dick.
I'm trying to project the picture now into full size so I could see it, and all of a sudden it flipped to something else.
Well, the link for everybody who wants to look at it is spark detector for alpha particles. That's just for the curiosity, and then because we have a limited time, I suggest to go to the first diagram that I have sent you. This diagram is also available, sent to Bernie, who wants to look at it.
Question on that tube there, maybe I'm making it. Isn't that essentially like a Geiger-Muller tube, you know, in air?
When I blew it up full size, I can now see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 wires. So he's got 5 parallel wires, and when he holds a nuclear source near the machine, the sparks don't seem to be favoring any one of the wires. The wires act like they're a complete sheet of high voltage, so to speak. Is that true, Wes?
That is correct. In other words, there is a proof of the factor that just by giving so extremely low amount of radioactive material that is safe to be held in hand, that is mounted in the commercially available devices, you make ideal spark up, but also talking about excitation of alpha particles.
So what's really nice about this thing is that I presume the high voltage brings the air up to the threshold where it could arc over, but it's below the threshold.
6,000 volts minimum.
Yeah, but the 6,000 volts is not arcing through the air all by itself. It's less than 30 kilovolts per centimeter.
That is correct. That's why he's using the radioactive material. At 6,000 volts, he's getting nice bunch of sparks.
So the radioactive material takes the air molecules that were not above threshold for arcing over, and it brings them into arc over, and yet each one of those arcs, after that radioactive part goes passing by, the arc automatically distinguishes itself. He doesn't have a high voltage dropping resistor which causes a quenching of the spark gap.
It's correct.
Now that's pretty crafty. So that is a kind of, I guess you could call it a cloud chamber that doesn't require the usual exaptamerol. That's kind of nice. What do you believe is the minimum threshold of radioactivity required for this thing to give its display?
Well, the one that is commercially available and is allowed to be sold to the public is about 5 millicurie, but based on my discussion with the Russian scientists, you could have even triggered it with 1 millicurie.
If I take apart my smoke detector, will I find enough radioactive material to do this experiment?
Correct.
Was one of those objects that he held the real one of the components from a typical smoke detector?
Correct.
Have you done that experiment, Wes?
No, I didn't, but I have enough of radioactive tubes that I have to make that experiment.
Now, I saw him hold 2 or 3 different objects in front of that display. What were those 2 or 3 objects, if you happen to know?
Yeah, one was 5 millicurie PO210, that is polonium source. The other was 60 millicurie AM241 source, and another one was 10 millicurie RA226 source. All of them easily to be purchased from the market. Apart from that, he states that the one that is the strongest one is sealed and is safe to behold.
I think you're saying I don't need a special license to buy any of these materials, and if I hold them in my hand or bring them near my body, I think you're saying they must be relatively safe. As long as I don't ingest them I'm safe. Is that approximately true?
That is correct.
If a really silly, foolish person were to take these objects apart, grind them up, and put them into food, my guess is that could be dangerous. Is that true?
That's what I believe is going to happen, definitely.
Since that capability exists, I'm a little bit amazed that without license, you're allowed to buy these things. Is there a supply house or on the internet where I could easily go and buy these things? And if so, do you have a guess as to what they cost?
Probably pennies, and those are mounted in the commercial available devices. You can buy the devices as a customer and use them for own use. That's what a guy sends on a video.
Do you intend to use a nuclear source near your spark gap of your experiment?
I already did so because those tubes that I have, it's a collection, and some of them are radioactive. I bought them legally, so I have no problem with that. And probably the amount of radioactivity over there is close to none, because they are 40 years old, 50 years old, or 30 years old. But it's an interesting project. I would suggest, because we have a little time left, and I would like to you to, I mean, if you would be able to talk to the board about the time of the repeater, I mean, real education is being diminished to 15 minutes time.
This email that you issued on...
Exactly in the same video, you have it as an attachment because you have a Linux system. In everybody else, it appears to be as a one email. So you have two attachments.
Yeah, the email you issued on 2/12 at 5:53 p.m., the top item is this YouTube video. The bottom item is a white graph with a number of sine wave-like patterns. Is that the next thing you want to discuss, Eric? I mean, oh, wait a minute. I got two of these graphs at the bottom. Okay. Should we look at those, or do you want to go to something else?
That's the one. Start with the top one.
I'm looking at the top white graph, and it's got one, two, three. It's got three sine waves and then a couple of other squigglies on there. So go ahead.
Okay, we're talking about this standing wave. Now, the upper one is voltage. You have also in Russian language, because this is done for not for the for American audience, but you have also in English. Now what is happening is more to the right hand side, you see in vertical line, you see a light bulb that is kind of gray, and to the left hand side you see the light bulb that is red. Do you see that?
I sure do. And a light bulb placed in that location, I can see why one would light and one would not. Go ahead.
Right. In other words, is at one point you have a maximum of voltage and close to zero current. If you online, you have a zero current. And this goes through the middle of the light bulb in vertical pattern.
Now, in order for that standing wave to be a literal standing wave where it is not propagating, that have to be a very high reflectivity on the right-hand side, which is not shown. In other words, these two wires, the two green wires, if they happen to be a twin-lead transmission line, the right-hand side would have to be either a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit in order for that standing wave to exist. Go ahead.
Correct. Now, what is happening is, instead of me drawing the line from that light bulb, gray light bulb, directly up and directly down, I put a little bit offset to the left and to the right. And the reason for that is that if I put the wires directly vertically up and down between two wires, we have a maximum voltage and zero current that would not light up.
Okay, so I think you're saying you disturb this diagram so that the gray light bulb on the right-hand side, the upper wire is displaced to the left, the lower wire is displaced to the right, and I think you're saying you did that displacement. Go ahead.
That is correct, and I did that because of the fact that when I go with the wire that is going to the top, to the left, then I have of course, all close to maximum voltage, but I have a little current on it. Now, the power is voltage time current. Now, my light bulb supposed to give the light.
With the amount of displacement you've shown, you might not get enough voltage to light that gray light bulb. Wes, go ahead.
Okay, now, let's go to the left-hand side. In the left-hand side, we have a light bulb that is that shows the light, and then go through the vertical line, and you'll have a zero voltage, or close to zero voltage, and then you have a maximum current. Now, because we have two wires together, they are 180 degrees in phase, flipped.
Now, that's the normal way of so-called differential mode of twin lead transmission line. I presume those two fat horizontal green lines represent the individual wires of a twin lead transmission line. Is that true?
That is correct. The only thing is that later on I want to replace one wire with the earth. And it's going to be a little bit of shock to some of the audience when I say that the sine wave traveled through the earth. But this was just a twin lead that shows over there. So we have, again, I put the offset with the wire to have a maximum current and a little bit of voltage. Now, one of the questions that I had is, voltage is the potential, current is the movement, is the motion. How come we could have, let's say I draw the wires not with the offset, but vertically up and vertically down, or have a zero voltage but maximum current, and the current is the motion. How come I can have in this particular point maximum current but no voltage?
If I had a wave traveling down a transmission line system, whether it be twin lead or coax, doesn't matter too much, a wave that is traveling, it has a E field, an H field, they've got a relationship between the two. When I cross E cross H, I get a pointing vector, I get a defined power transfer, and you can't separate the E from the H, you can't separate the H from the E on a traveling wave.
Yeah, but we have a traveling torque, I mean a current, I'm sorry. Traveling current, that means the current is the movement, it's a motion. When we have a zero voltage and maximum current, would that light bulb be leading or not?
Okay, what I was going to say, I didn't get a chance to finish it, was that the E and H are inseparable items on the normal transmission. When I create a short circuit at one end and reflect the wave back, now you get this peculiar characteristic where at some positions you have a voltage and very little current. At some positions you have a current and very little voltage. That's not a normal transmission phenomena. That is two separate transmissions, one going from left to right, one going from right to left, and they're folded on top of each other. And at certain positions, the voltage of the forward going wave and the voltage of the reverse going wave, they add up in one particular position. And in another position, they're continuously canceling, and we call one the current point and one the voltage point. You think you can separate voltage and current and say that, hey, the power is being covered, the voltage, or the power is being carried by the current?
I'm just asking the question. Let's say I didn't put the offset, I just put the wire up and down from the red light bulb, up and down. We have at this point zero voltage and maximum current. What would happen to the light on the light bulb?
Hold on now. If I made this as a slow motion movie, and this is a particular frame of the movie, and above the red light bulb you see the voltage going up, below the red light bulb you see the voltage going down. Tell me what you think that voltage waveform at that location would look like a half a wavelength later in time. I'm going to keep the exact same position, but I'm now going to let the clock run for a half wavelength in time and then stop the clock and look at it again. Tell me what you think those voltage waveforms would look like above and below the red bulb, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN, I send this question to John as we analyze the schematic, and he's pretty much better in English than me. John?
Right now, on the right-hand side, I'm seeing English.
Oh, yeah, I understand. But we discussed that schematic with John for a few hours, John.
Well, let me tell you the answer, because we're a little short on time. A half wavelength later, where that black line representing voltage above the green line is upward, a half wavelength later, that black line is going to be down below the green line. And on the lower green wire, the black wire that's the black line that's below is going to be above. So that if you could slowly roll the movie forward, you would see a blur of the black line. The black area would be up and down blurred right above and below that red light bulb. That there would be a continuous motion of that black wave in that area. And you go a little bit, you go a quarter wavelength to the right where the black line crosses the green line, both above and below. That position, there'll never be any black line displaced from the green. You'll just see it pivot. So in that position, you'll see the black line pivoting, but right above and below the red light bulb, you'll see the black line moving up and down. You'll see a continuous blur in that area. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Curls.
Somebody said curl. What do you mean by that?
I think he said pearls. The pearls?
Okay. If I allowed the movie to run and blur, yes, I'm going to get a pearl in the vicinity of the red light bulb, but in the vicinity, just a quarter wavelength to the right of it, or the vicinity of the gray light bulb, that's going to be the string between the pearls. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, I just want to point out, and then I'll let Wesley get back, the upper black sine wave is the voltage reference. Those other two between the green lines, that's the current reference.
There's a problem. Once you set up a standing wave, there is a certain place where current is going to be maximum, and it's going to swing back and forth, positive and negative, by the way.
We did. If you look at the voltage is zero, current is maximum.
Okay. The upper black curve on that white page, does that represent the forward-going waveform? John, go ahead.
That is a description of the AC voltage going up and down. The other two are current. But Wesley, I think you should move on to your space between the feet question before we run out of time.
Okay. Now, let's say we replace the lower wire, green wire, with the air ground. And I'm not going to go to the positive right now because we don't have a time for it. If you have a ground and you have a high voltage wire that you drop to the ground, the supplier gave 50 hertz, 220 volts, 110 volts, whatever it is, 10,000 volts, whatever it is, 100,000 volts. Now, the person that is standing 10 meters from that wire, through his legs, he can feel the current and the voltage. Now, that would be sinusoidal wave because the supplier made it alternated. That means that if he is standing far away from that wire and he feels the current, the voltage is alternated, that means through air we have a transmission of the sine waves. Over there. So the ground is acting as a wire. Let me jump. Now, at this point, this man, when you see on that red light bulb, he is walking, he has 2 feet over there. Now we replace the lower green wire with the F structure. So we have an upper wire and the F structure. Now, if you try to draw right now the equivalent circuit, what's going on between legs of this person? And what is the current, what is the voltage between the legs of this person in this particular situation?
Good question, but there's something even bigger going on here, John and Wes, and that is on that first white page, at the bottom of the page, you see a man standing on a bumpy piece of ground, and the left-hand guy is standing near the red light bulb, the right-hand guy is standing near the gray light bulb. If that upper green wire was a transmission line sending voltage from Canada down to Long Island. No matter where he stood, no matter where he touched the wire, he would be electrocuted. If the right-hand side of the wire is perfectly grounded, and you've got a perfect standing wave, now there are some specific locations where he can stand where he doesn't get electrocuted, because there's a waveform going from left to right and a waveform going to right to left, and in certain places they cancel.
Yeah, they say yes and no, nodes.
But if this was under ordinary circumstances in a 60 cycle or a 50 hertz power transmission system, you do not get significant standing waves. That power station could not tolerate that. At radio frequencies, maybe, but at 60 hertz, you couldn't do this. No matter where you stand on a high voltage transmission line system, there are no magic places where you're safe. No matter where you stand, you touch that wire, you're dead.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have 3 minutes left, so that means that that the higher the frequency, the different scenario we have. Now we're going more to the bottom of that, and now we see the man that is holding with his hand one wire, and then he is at the ground. Now, question again is not what is going between his hand and the ground, because I mean, yes, that's the question. Because he's at maximum current and 0 volts. If you look at him, he is at maximum current and he's 0 volts. Now he touched one wire and the other wire is the ground. What's going to happen to this man? At the frequency of 100 kilohertz.
Okay. No matter what the frequency is, when he's standing there, and I think you're worried about, is there a voltage drop between his 2 feet?
There's no voltage. There is no voltage. There is only current. The voltage is zero.
Are you saying under no circumstances is there a potential difference between his left foot and his right foot? Is that what you're saying?
No. Forget about the foot. Just look at him. The very lower, you have a one line when the bumpy grind is, and low. Look a little bit lower. You have another two men standing, and you see the green wire only. Now, the green wire is one wire, and the ground is second wire. Now, we have no more time to do it. I would appreciate if that one man who made this TechNet short for real education just rethink that. And if you could, talk to the bosses and to HGN.
When it comes to that man standing on the bottom of the first white sheet, are you worried about whether or not he does or doesn't see a voltage between his hand and his feet? Is that what you're worried about, Wes?
Yes. Basically, what it looks like from the graph, he would have zero voltage and maximum current through his body.
As I said before, if this is a 50 hertz or a 60 hertz real transmission system, there is no standing wave of any significant percentage on that wire. The whole darn wire, every inch of it, every mile of it, is hot. There is no cold spot. And there's no way on a normal power transmission system without burning up the power station that you could really set up a standing wave. In the case of a standing wave,
100 kilohertz.
Oh, in other words, you want to run this power station at 100 kilohertz.
That's correct. That's my example. It's 100 kilohertz. Now, the man is touching to the green wire and is standing on the earth. Now, he has, through the graph, zero voltage, maximum current.
Even if you operate it at 100 kilohertz, he only has safe spots and unsafe spots if there is a nearly one-to-one standing wave ratio. I shouldn't say one-to-one, an infinite standing wave ratio. And you have to have a signal generator that can tolerate a standing wave, a complete short circuit. You have to make the length of the transmission line some even number, let me think now, odd number of quarter wavelengths. It's got odd number of quarter wavelengths, so that the short circuit at one end looks like an open circuit at the signal generator end. So there's got to be a very specific length of that line for you to be able to set up a standing wave with a normal signal generator. Is that making some clearness so far?
Yes, it is. My question is, if you look at the three wave shapes the voltage and two currents. Now we replace the lower wire with the air. We look at the bottom of the chart that I made. I was working on it a few days with all of the revisions. Revision 9 is here. Okay. Now I have only a few minutes left. Now question then is, if we just look at the graph, forget about do we have real situation, we have a theoretical situation. What happened to the body of that man between his hand and his leg? He has that is touching to the ground. If we have a zero voltage and maximum current,
if you really have a complete standing wave on that transmission line system, and there really is a place where there is nearly zero voltage, where the black wire is just wiggling back and forth, and there really is zero volt there, there's a very strong magnetic field there, but there's no voltage there. So voltage-wise, he's safe. Now the oscillating at 100 kc magnetic field, that's still going to do something to him if he's standing near it, if you know what I mean. Over to you, KQRIW.
That's the whole question. The question is, if we just operate in theoretical situation, we have a maximum current and zero voltage, and you say that it's something that is going to happen to him, that we have a real situation to discuss. We have a real, event in here.
Because he's going to be standing...
Good night, Dick. Thank you.
John, go to 147.
KC2WGB, clear QSY.
WQVL repeater system. Good morning.
N2EV moment.
The time is 5:31 a.m. Good morning. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. The time is 5:41 a.m. Good morning.
KB2VBN Far Rockaway on the beach. BBN stand by at this time on Monday.
Good morning. The time is 5:51 a.m. W2VL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
T-Mobile listening.
Good morning.